I'm going to talk today about magnetic fields and activity on fully convective stars. Actually, I've thrown in a lot of other stuff based on or inspired by the talks that we've heard the past couple of days. If you were here for the three-day meeting to begin this workshop and saw my talk, you will recognize a lot of it, but it's not exactly the same, so don't go to sleep. An outline, well, you can go to sleep, I don't care. An outline for the talk is I'll sort of give a brief introduction to some of the main players, and so the fully convective stars I'm going to consider. Give some comments about rotation activity relationships, and then show a little bit of Doppler imaging results and discuss that a little bit more than I did in the previous talk, particularly in light of yesterday's talk. Talk some then about differential rotation, and to preview that, I'll just say that one of the main results from Doppler imaging studies have been these polar spots. All rapidly rotating stars that have been Doppler imaged seem to show very large polar spots. And there's a bit of a chicken and egg problem here, because that assumes solid body rotation for the star. The inversion process assumes solid body rotation. If it's not solid body, if that is not the case, then that can strongly affect the recovered image, and that can either reinforce polar spots or it can make them go away. I'll then discuss how we measure magnetic fields, give some results for mid-M-dwarfs, fully convective M-dwarfs, on their magnetic field measurements and some of the properties we determine from that. Then I'll discuss T-Tauri stars, which are the other group of fully convective stars that we've observed a lot. Then I'll discuss a little bit about iron hydride, because it provides us a way to extend the work to brown dwarfs. And there's some reasons people want to do that. And then I'll give some concluding remarks. But before we launch into that, I always like to point out to cool star people that there are these AP stars. And these AP stars have very large magnetic fields. This is the splitting of the H-alpha line in right and left circularly polarized light due to roughly a 34 kilogauss, nearly dipolar field on the surface of this AP star. And one of the general results from AP stars is they all have very much dipole-like fields. They're not pure dipoles, but they're pretty close to dipoles. And the question is, well, where do these fields come from? Now, some of these stars are believed to have convective cores, and so there have been models proposed that you have an interface zone, kind of like the base of the solar convection zone, but you have this interface zone between an outer radiative zone and an inner convective core that then produces these magnetic fields. But these magnetic fields are always produced as large-scale dipoles, not as the big random mess that you see them.
Can you explain why it's possible to have convective core and radiative exterior? Doesn't sound usual.
It is very common for massive stars.
Yeah, I mean,
it has to do with the temperature. Isn't it the carbon cycle stars?
Yes, the temperature sensitivity is so high that you don't have enough area for the energy to get out from the core.
A very sharp gradient temperature, which is convectively unstable.
But I thought that in convective cores, the transition was a lot softer than in the sun, because the transition from convective to stable happens because of the flux divergence, the 1 over r squared area effect.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of an opacity thing like in the sun.
Right. I certainly don't work on AP stars, so I don't know the detailed inner structure, but you have to explain these fields somehow.
I was just wondering wouldn't it be the convective core itself rather than the interface layer?
I think people don't really know, and the idea that I sort of like is these may be primordial fields. They may be unrelated to convection and dynamo in the stars at all. They may be left over from the star formation process. I'm not going to really introduce M-dwarfs, because M-dwarfs are just main sequence, low-mass main sequence stars, and at about M3, or about 0.3 solar masses, they become fully convective. People may not be so familiar with T-Tauri stars. T-Tauri stars are pre-main sequence stars, shown here as a piece of an HR diagram. So you have a log of the effective temperature here, log of the luminosity here. The main sequence is sort of cutting through at this lower line. And what is shown here are a number of T-Tauri stars. The dashed lines show tracks that these stars follow. So when they're first when they're born and can first be seen at an age of about 10 to the 5 years, a half solar mass star would start evolving downward in its fully convective stage until eventually it develops a radiative core and then evolves to the left in the HR diagram, eventually reaching the main sequence at somewhere around 10 to the 8 years. Most of the T Tauri stars are in this region where they are ages of a few times 10 to the 6 years. This is this uppermost line here. That's the birth line from Steve Stoller and those are these vertical lines that they evolve down. The solid lines cutting this way are isochrones, so they're just different points of constant age on this diagram.
How come you have several lines? I thought there's just one line.
Are you talking about a limiting one for the lowest mass stars? That would be off to the right in this diagram. Well, the mass range is from 0.1 up to, well, over here. Here's 1.2.
There's a stability line, and stars would be dynamically unstable towards the right.
Right, but that's over here.
Okay, then that is probably the traditional.
That would be the, but that's it way in the brown dwarf limit. And these are stars.
You actually talk about the thing, then you have to worry about all the molecules and everything else and the dust that's around them.
Right, well.
It's a simplified picture. Let's
Chris, why is a line of vertical line of data points at 3.6?
Because all these log temperatures are determined from spectral types, which is not particularly easy to do for T Tauri stars because they have accretion going on, and so that kind of masks the lines. And so a lot of them are around the spectral type of K7. And to tell exactly the difference between a K7 and an M0 or something like that, or an M1, that's a little bit hard to do just from a general spectral analysis. And spectral typing gives you very strict demarcations in effective temperature.
Okay, so
right.
Yeah.
Bins, right.
And most of them fall in one bin.
Right. Well, there's most of them are here. Then you have some here, okay. Some along this line. It's just that the spectral typing isn't that precise. And just to give a little bit further introduction, because some of the stars we'll be talking about are classical T Tauri stars. And they have these extra features in that they are surrounded by an accretion disk. It's believed this accretion disk is truncated close to the star by a dipolar field from the star. But disk material falls onto the star, and when it hits the star, it shocks. It produces a lot of ultraviolet and optical emission. That's why spectral typing is kind of hard, because when you look at a classical T Tauri star, you're seeing a lot of emission from this accretion shock in addition to the stellar photosphere. It just makes the process difficult. The one thing that I should say, though, is the accretion shocks are expected to produce significant amounts of ultraviolet emission and optical emission, but not really much X-ray emission. So if you want to look at X-rays and measure coronae and get some idea of the activity of T Tauri stars, X-rays are generally unaffected by accretion and the processes that make T Tauri stars weird.
Chris, and I have a question. How do you know that there's a disk there? I mean, how does it show up?
It shows up primarily in the fact that there's an infrared excess. There's a lot more infrared light coming out than a standard stellar photosphere. And if you thought so that tells you there's dust basically around the star. If you assume that dust is spherically distributed, you wouldn't expect to see the star. The opacity would be much too high, and you just wouldn't see the star. So that gives you some clue that it's a flattened structure. And if you then do more detailed fitting of the spectral energy distribution, you find that fairly flattened structures do the best job. And now with HST, we have these pictures of propylids in Orion, these little disc-like things. So we really see things that look like discs around these types of stars. And so there are actually even a few T Tauri stars where the disks are more or less edge-on, and they scatter light. And so you'll see these stars with a very dark lane and the scattering profile above and below it. So there's lots of photographic evidence, basically, for disks these days. So this notion of the rotation-activity relationship is a pretty standard thing in cool star research these days. What I'm showing here is the inverse Rossby number, so a measure of the strength of the dynamo, and showing a measure of stellar activity, chromospheric activity, or coronal activity. Here, this is the log RHK prime. It's a measure of the emission coming out in the calcium H and K lines. So that's chromospheric, a chromospheric tracer. Shown here is the X-ray luminosity over the bolometric luminosity. And there's a pretty much one-to-one correspondence between these two quantities. So actually, for example, these red points are actual X-ray measurements. The yellow points are actual calcium measurements. But when people look at the same stars with both of them, they can make a fairly one-to-one correspondence between the two types of emissions so that you can put them on the same diagram.
What's the calcium?
Convective turnover time. And that's typically measured one scale height above the base of the convection zone. As you got to fix it at some point. You can fix it at the equator. You can fix it right at the base of the convection zone. It's usually measured one scale height above the base of the convection zone. You just got to pick some representative place.
And that's how do you get that?
From models.
Mixing link
theory, basically. And what is seen then is a growth of chromospheric or coronal activity with decreasing rotation period or increasing convective turnover time up to some point where the emission appears to level off. And this is what has been termed saturation, that the emission is, that the activity is saturating at a inverse Rossby number near 10. One thing I'll point out, I don't actually show any T Tauri stars on this diagram, but this is where you would expect them to lie in terms of their dynamo numbers. I know this isn't a stellar crowd, but if you ever, one of the things that really bugs me about the people who do T Tauri star research, and particularly X-rays emission from T Tauri stars, they seem to have never heard of the Rossby number, or the inverse Rossby number. They always plot these T Tauri stars with rotation period. And the rotation periods of T Tauri stars are fast. I mean, they're of the order of a few days. But if you were to put them in on a plot with main sequence stars, you would expect them to fall in this region based only on rotation period, where there should be some correlation with rotation. But if, in fact, you look at the models and note that their convective turnover times are much larger than main sequence stars because they're fully convective, you really expect them to lie in this saturated region. And so people have made big deals of the fact that T Tauri stars don't show any correlation in their X-ray emission with rotation, and the answer is they shouldn't show any emission, any correlation, if it has a similar type of dynamo. Now, on the other hand, the T Tauri stars are fully convective, so there is no tachocline region. You don't have a place where the dynamo that we think in the sun is producing the cyclic part of the dynamo. That region doesn't exist in these stars, so you may expect them to be different.
What about this idea of Lorentz, that these stars are not really fully convective?
And why did he say that?
I don't remember the reason. He said that, that in fact you don't get fully convective stars until you get down to where you get the full open activity of the round hole.
Well, I mean, I've looked at some of the most recent, that being, say, 1996, models of D'Antoni and Mazzitelli, who are sort of the main group that create stellar structure models for pre-main sequence stars. And at about a half a solar mass and below, so this track through here, they're pretty much all fully convective until you get to nearly 10 million years old. And so that would encompass most of the T Tauri stars that we study.
You had a different set of models.
Okay. I mean, there are different groups, but if it was it his impression that the inner radius zone was very large, or just, you know, very tiny?
No, it wasn't very large. Mm-hmm. It wasn't insignificant.
Okay.
Part of the argument was, do you really have a dynamo when you don't have any radiative core?
Well, I guess my general response to that is, and Suzanne's going to talk more about this next week, we see things that are M9 stars where we are really sure they're fully convective, and they've got H-alpha emission, they've got X-ray emission, and so forth. So they are doing something that looks like magnetic activity.
But then you also have to explain why when you go to still smaller masses, it falls off.
Okay. I think the answer to that is it's because as you go to very small masses, the outer regions are becoming more and more neutral. They can, therefore, their coupling to the magnetic field is less efficient, so their ability to heat the outer, the chromosphere and the corona becomes less efficient. I don't think it means that the field isn't there. And it's the end of my talk, but the iron hydride I'm going to tell you about. Iron hydride turns out to be a magnetically sensitive molecule. And we can see iron hydride in things that are right at the brown dwarf limit, and it looks like they show magnetic fields. So,
can I ask you, we're all expert in dynamo here.
Great.
You citing Rossby number as a sort of dynamo affiliation. Show the picture,
sure.
back to the picture. But I can make the dynamo with Rossby number less than one, with Rossby number more than one, in particular talking about large scale fields like dipole.
Right. Well, I'm not saying the dynamo. I'm not saying the dynamo is shutting off. All I'm saying is that its appearance, its effect on heating a corona or heating a chromosphere, appears to flatten out at this Rossby number. It's not that I don't think there is a dynamo going on, and so people have tried to argue: is this a filling factor effect? Does this mean that the filling factor of coronal loops has become one, and therefore you just can't add any more emission? I don't think anybody's claiming that the dynamo has shut off, but maybe it's changed its efficiency, or maybe it's a heating problem. And I use that actually as a justification for why we need to go out and measure magnetic fields, because right now this diagram has two things in it. It has a dynamo and it has heating. And by measuring the magnetic fields, we can get rid of that heating question.
I think you invite some extra. I can buy that it's better to plot dimensionless number, like what Rossby suggested, which invites rotation and convection. That's what you actually plot. But when you put the word dynamo and magnetic field, that's something you...
Well, I put it in quotation marks.
which only confuse just me.
Okay, well...
I would stay off the dynamo at this point.
Okay, but... I'll skip to this diagram, which I think has been shown here before already. I mean, there seems to be a fairly strong correlation between X-ray emission and magnetic flux in regions where we can actually measure the magnetic field. So here we've actually measured the magnetic field. We're not pulling out somebody's relationship for LX and magnetic field. We're actually measuring the thing. And so over many orders of magnitude, a lot of X-ray emission, the X-ray emission correlates pretty well with the magnetic flux. So I would go back and say here that this quantity tells you that there's magnetic field there. Yeah.
I was going to say that, I mean, you can have a dynamo if there's no rotation. It's just the,
sure.
It's the convective dynamo.
Right.
And as long as you're not interested in, say, actually cycle theory or something like that.
I told you, you invite a lot of...
Well, and that's fine.
The matter is, there's a correlation.
Yeah, I mean, this correlation is very strong, and, I mean, down here, I'm going down, and we don't know exactly how far. This, I didn't bring anything on basal flux, but there is a lower limit to calcium emission. When you go to stars that aren't rotating at any detectable level, they still have calcium emission, and that's probably this turbulent dynamo. There's been a lot of work done on acoustic heating, though, and there's some dispute as to whether it's acoustic or magnetic in origin, but at the slowest rotation, you still do see calcium emission. You see chromospheric signatures.
What would it take to put that actually onto the plot? I mean, where would you be, and why haven't you extended the plot to show these?
Because those guys do all their measurements with magnesium 2, and I don't know what the relationship between magnesium 2 and
no
calcium is. I don't know that people have looked with X-rays at those stars in any big survey. And as Dana said, I mean, the correlation certainly is there. So either you're saying that the dynamo is more efficient with rotation, or you're saying the field doesn't change, but the heating somehow changes with rotation.
But you're also saying that the correlation is much better with velocity number than it is just with rotation.
Yes and no, in the sense that... Well, I here now I've switched to UV emission just because this is where I have the data. And the squares are main sequence stars. The diamonds are RSCVN stars. Okay, so they have different internal structures. If you look only at rotation period, you get this plot. And you can see there is generally a correlation in carbon-4 surface flux with decreasing rotation. And that's true in the main sequence stars. That's true in the RSCVN stars, but they fall on different lines. They don't fall on the same line. If you then put in the Rossby number, inverse Rossby number, they fall more or less on the same line. And so that's why people prefer observationally to use this inverse Rossby number as opposed to just rotation.
It's better to look for dimensionless numbers anyway, in principle, I think.
The other thing I want to point out from these plots, these solid lines, these solid circles are classical T Tauri stars. We think that this is accretion-related emission, so you should ignore them. There are four fully convective stars on this diagram, these two asterisks here and these two diamonds here. And they're at the lower end of things, and that may or may not be significant. If we go to this diagram where you're looking at magnetic flux and X-ray emission, these are the fully convective stars here. We've now added three more stars to this diagram, and they all fall below the line generally defined by the other stars. These are all solar features, these guys, and these guys. These are other stars. If you were to draw a line just through the other stars, it would be above the T Tauri stars. And you have some advantage by just looking at these guys here because they're all measured with basically the same instruments. These guys down here have different satellites looking at slightly different wave bands. The translation between the two is a little bit more difficult. But these guys up here are all measured with the same instruments. And so it's a easier correlation to make. Getting more back to, showing the sun here. One of the things, of course, that we note is the cyclic nature of the magnetic field on the sun, going from very active through a quiet and back to active again. Another comment to make, though, a lot of our detailed solar work and knowledge comes from pictures like this, where you have the resolved sun and you're measuring the line of sight field. So you have very strong field where it's either white or black, near zero field where it's gray, and then the white is positive and the black is negative polarity.
What is 11 volts?
You have to complain to Carl Shriver. This may be one of those shorter cycles than one of the longer cycles. But the point here is that if you average...
7 years. No, he has been finished. The picture is finishing.
If you average this line of sight field over the entire disk, you get a number very close to zero. You get something that is basically plus or minus 1 to 2 Gauss, even though the field in the active regions may be as high as 1500, 1600 Gauss. In the spots, it's 3000 Gauss or something like that. But when you look at the sun as a star and you look in polarized light, it shows almost no signature. And that's a big hindrance for us to look at other stars, because other solar-like stars also show basically no signature. Even though there may be a whole lot of magnetic field there, the polarization data doesn't reveal it. But of course, one of the things that the sun has is activity cycles. And so one of the questions is, what is evidence for the activity cycles on other stars? And this is data from, again, the Calcium HK project. This is a measure of chromospheric activity as a function of time here, and there are several stars that show what looks to be cyclic activity in their chromospheric emission. So you see clear evidence for what we would term activity cycles on other solar-like stars. Unfortunately, there's almost no information about M stars. The study was started many years ago, 30 years ago, and the stars that were really available to them were F, G, and K dwarfs. Nothing really about M dwarfs. So we really don't know what are the activity cycle properties of M dwarfs, particularly fully convective M dwarfs. You might expect there to be no activity cycle, but observationally, we don't know one way or another.
It's one M star.
Yeah, but it's like an M0 star. It's not fully convective.
Is it right that the exposure times are like 1 hour?
Well, for the telescope that they're using, yeah. If you were to go to a bigger telescope, a 3-meter class telescope, then you could get exposure times down. You might want to go to another, I mean, calcium is pretty far blue. You might want to switch to infrared triplet line or H-alpha or some other index where there's more emission coming out in an M dwarf. One thing, though, that this can tell us, or the calcium study can tell us, is some evidence for differential rotation. Shown here is one of the one cycle on the sun, the solar butterfly diagram. So you have the emergence of spots and active regions changing as a function of changing their latitude as a function of the activity cycle. And so for a star that's differentially rotating like the sun, you would get a different rotation period if you were monitoring an active region here than if you were monitoring an active region at low latitude. And in fact, this is what you get when you look at the sun as a star. You look at the global calcium emission of the sun as a star. You analyze it. Here's its S index, that calcium strength. So it's falling through the end of one activity cycle and growing into the next activity cycle. And if you then measure the rotation period simply by doing a periodogram analysis on the calcium data, say every year, you get a rotation period that's 26 days. It drops down to 24 days as you become more dominated by equatorial regions. It jumps back up to 28 days when you switch over to being dominated by the higher latitude regions, and it begins to fall again. So this is what the differential rotation profile of the sun looks like in calcium 2 when analyzed as a star. Do we see any evidence for that on other stars? Well, in fact, we do. Here's a couple of stars. Now, these are both similar spectral types. Their activity cycles are here. Their rotation periods are here. So this one's similar to the sun in that it's going down, it jumps up, and then gradually goes down again. But here's one that goes in the opposite direction, exactly opposite to what the sun is doing. So either, if the basic interpretation of a butterfly diagram is right, either this star has differential rotation with the pole spinning faster than the equator, or its active regions are emerging first at the equator, then at high latitude as the cycle goes on. And the stars aren't that different. So a dynamo theory needs to be able to account for these types of behaviors. Switching over to Doppler imaging, now again, those were all for solar-like stars. As I mentioned earlier, one of the things that Doppler imaging can show you is a picture, a surface map of the temperature, say. And so this is the temperature on this RSCVN star. And what you typically find is a dark spot near the equator, and dark meaning that it's on the order, on the pole. Dark meaning that it's of the order of 1,000 degrees cooler at the pole than it is at the equator.
It's not monotonic. It's just a spot where you can see the gradual drop from equator to the pole.
Ideally, a Doppler imaging analysis can give you a fairly detailed picture, and so if there are spots at different places, you will see those. And so it's not any longitude slice doesn't necessarily have to be have the same temperature trace. You can have a spot somewhere and not a spot somewhere else. I'm not sure.
I guess I have to say, is a sporty star. You have some variation.
Yeah.
So it's steady gradient between the crater and core.
For most of these stars, there is some variation, so it's not a purely axisymmetric distribution. But the dominant feature is a more or less axisymmetric thing with a spot at the pole.
And they're rotating how much faster than the sun?
These are rotating substantially faster. It varies from star to star. The rotation, the V sine I of this thing is on the order of 60 kilometers per second. And it's a bigger star, but that means its period is still only a day or two. So it's rotating significantly faster.
Very fast.
Very fast. And in fact, this particular guy isn't. I'll show some pictures for some fully convective stars.
Does that mean a radiative core or a convective core?
Radiative core.
And
convective envelope.
The symmetry is very unusual property, which is against any sunspot.
I mean, it's just almost really axisymmetric in this temperature. Then you wouldn't be able to see anything in Doppler.
Well, that's okay. I'm going to. What does Doppler imaging do? You have to look at fast, rapidly rotating stars because that's the only thing you can really do Doppler imaging on. And what you're doing is you're looking, you take a time series of spectra, high-resolution spectra. So here's the line profile. This is now of a T Tauri star. The data are the dots. And if it's not axisymmetric, you will see a little feature kind of like this guy, but you'll see it appear, say, on the blue side of the profile, and it'll move through the profile and disappear on the red side. That would be what you would get if there was a spot more or less at the equator that moved across the surface of the star as it was rotating. If it's purely axisymmetric, you don't see any features that move, but the line shape isn't what you would predict for a solid body rotating object. The line shape changes, and if you have a polar spot, the core fills in, so you get a more flat bottom thing. If you have something that's differentially rotating, if in fact it's differentially rotating like the sun, you get this dash dot line. Okay? And if you have something that is differentially rotating with the opposite profile to the sun, you then also get something that fills in. And so the thing I want to stress here is the filling in of the line core can be done either by a polar spot or by differential rotation that has a pole rotating faster than the equator. A pole rotating slower than the equator produces more of a triangular shaped profile, this one shown in the dash dot line. And so the purpose of this particular paper was to look for evidence of differential rotation on rapidly rotating T Tauri stars, because there was a prediction that they should be strongly differentially rotating with a difference between the pole and the equator greater than what we observe in the sun. You can see from this plot that that's not the case. It would look like this dash dot line if it was differentially rotating like the sun. But then you have a problem. What if you have a star with a polar spot that is strongly differentially rotating? The polar spot makes the line go one way.
What do you mean by polar? If I feel a 60, 50 degrees by spots, can you distinguish?
Are you asking if you put a ring?
Somewhere.
Yeah. Depending on the quality of the data, you can distinguish, because what happens is instead of being completely flat bottom, you would get a little dip in the middle of the profile, or you'd get a little rise in the profile. So you have some ability to distinguish latitude, but it's hard, just because what you're really doing with Doppler imaging is you're mapping each velocity bin in the line profile to a constant linear bin on the star. So all the points on the star that are like this have the same Doppler shift. And so all these points are contributing to the line profile at the same place. So there's a blurring in longitude. You can't, it's not, it just isn't perfect.
A couple of days ago, Mark showed us theoretically that it's possible to have acceleration and rotation near poles.
Right.
That's not excluded.
Right. And in general, that's what we see with our T-Tauri stars. We see a slight polar acceleration, except that you now have the question, well, is that a polar acceleration or is that a polar spot? Now, here's another picture for a different star. This is a T-Tauri star. This is now a fully convective star that we've analyzed. And this is the image reconstruction. And so, assuming solid body rotation, again, we get this fairly strong polar spot. If I were to allow it to be differentially rotating with the pole spinning faster than the equator, with the difference being about half the solar difference, I would completely erase that polar spot. It wouldn't be there, and you would get...
That's more probable. So this is the interaction.
Well, yes.
Well, I'd like to say something in favor of the polar spot, at least theoretically,
mm-hmm.
because these are rapid rotators. Mm-hmm. You can imagine that these are more like Jupiter than like the Sun, and if they're like Jupiter, you expect they will have a very strong dipole component to the field. And a strong dipole component will mean to be a strong polar magnetic field, which would cause, you know, temperature to drop to the pole.
No, not to that extent. The dipole itself. Now you can see it every AP star. It's more like the Earth's polar regions where we have cold jets near the north or south poles. And that's what NHD people are writing.
Well, let me.
The convective people want to comment on that.
That's what I was wondering actually. If it has anything to do with the, you see in young stellar objects, you see these jets. Many of them have jets.
But those are connected to the disk.
Those
are driven by this. For young stellar objects that don't have disks, they don't have jets. All the ones that have jets have disks. So it's really a disk phenomena, not a stellar phenomena.
So it's not likely these spots are just big, huge sunspots that sit there.
Well,
strong magnetic
fields. By the time we get to the end of my talk, I will have argued that the young stars have strong magnetic field everywhere on their surface. So yes, there are strong fields at the pole, but there are strong fields at the equator too. Let me get back to the polar spots real quick, in the sense that the sort of the old explanation was the Coriolis force acting on flux tubes rising from a dynamo at the interface of the radiative and convection zone. So if you have, say you release a flux tube, even at a fairly equatorial attitude, the Coriolis force redirects its buoyant rise to someplace near the pole. And that the faster it's rotating, the more polar concentrated it gets. The smaller the core, the smaller the inner radiative core, the more polar concentrated it gets. And so this was the explanation that I had heard for some time. However, we do see the polar spots on T-Tauri stars. Even the fully convective ones are the ones that I think are fully convective. And so it's less clear that this type of dynamo is operating so that this type of process can happen. But still, if you're producing field deep in the star from a turbulent dynamo, it could then maybe buoyantly rise and be affected by the Coriolis force. But I was very intrigued to hear yesterday in Mark's talk that this could simply be a temperature effect. And I'll get back to maybe how we can address that, but let me
just comment. When you asked if how much influence rotation can make on convection efficiency,
yeah.
It makes a big difference if it's fully convective. I didn't realize.
So does that mean it doesn't work if it's fully convective? Yeah. I mean, we've got examples that are both.
Less influence if it's fully
convective. Okay, but for example...
If you have the base of the convection zone, the tangent cylinder is an important place.
Okay.
And convection inside the tangent cylinder is suppressed.
Okay.
So if you have a convective envelope like the sun, and you rotate it fast, you can cut off convection at the poles.
Okay.
But if you have a fully convective star, there's still a variation in heat flux with latitude, but I'm not sure you get the same effect. I'm not sure you can get like a 50% variation.
Right.
What's the rose vinyama at this star?
The couple hundred.
Bands.
Or inverse Rossby numbers, a couple hundred. But even, I mean, we have examples of these polar spots for main sequence stars. Here is a Pleiades star, and so it's rapidly rotating just because it's young. But it's a K0 main sequence star, so it has a radiative core, and this is now a polar projection of the image, and again, it has this spot concentrated near the pole. You can see it's not axisymmetric. So it's not purely axisymmetric, but the dominant feature is, again, a dark spot observed near the pole. So most of the objects that we've done this Doppler imaging on do have radiative interiors. Only a few of the T-Tauri stars that we think are fully convective have had Doppler imaging done on them. And it's just because they aren't rotating that fast, and they're faint. And so operationally, we just can't do the Doppler imaging.
Chris, how often when you see the polar spots, do you see that kind of non-axisymmetric?
Well, I mean, we pretty much always see it as being not axisymmetric. But if it was purely axisymmetric and you throw noise on your observations, the inversion would likely produce something that wasn't completely axisymmetric. On the other hand, I mean, this is a pretty strong non-axisymmetric spot. And so there are some where I would say, yes, there's no question, they're not axisymmetric. And there are others where, even though the image sort of looks non-axisymmetric, I'd say, well, it's not inconsistent with an axisymmetric.
But if you took them all mm-hmm. these observations together,
mm-hmm.
if you're going to explain this whole group without recourse to polar spots, then all of the non-axisymmetry has to be explained by noise. And I would think your chi-squared would be phenomenally large. Essentially, you know, you can take only the axisymmetric ones and say that.
Right.
You know, then you've got these other ones that have to be polar spots, and then you have to go back and say, what, you know.
Yeah, but even so, if you're going to operate for some other explanation for the polar spot, the inhibition of convection due to rotation or whatever, that can take out the axisymmetric component, and then what you're left with is just two isolated spots that maybe aren't right at the pole, okay? And that gives you a pretty different idea, mental picture of what's going on. So I think it's still important to know what's going on. One way you can hope to do it is to look at things like TIO. I mean, that gives you some constraint over whether or not it's just a differential rotation with an inverse relationship then to the sun, or if there really is a spot there. Because, for example, around 7126 angstroms, there's a titanium oxide band head, and if you start putting a lot of cool material on the star, you get something that gets that appears. The TIO appears only at cold temperature, and so you can distinguish.
It's not accurate to say inverse relationship. What Mark showed, it could be the same relationship, but some acceleration
sure.
near the pole.
But if you have only some acceleration near the poles, I'm not sure it would make that much of a difference in our Doppler imaging, because you know, as you get more and more equator on, that becomes a very small point on the star. It maps to a very small point in the line profile, and it's difficult to it just wouldn't make that big a difference on the line profile. So you really need something that's more global in its behavior. So anyway, I just put this forward to say that there are ways you can address whether or not it's a temperature effect or a differential rotation effect.
So which that is then? You're saying that the amount of TIO there
indicates
it's hot.
The amount of TIO here indicates that the solid line here is the TIO that is consistent with what people think are the observed polar spot. This is the TIO that would be required. It's sort of a long story, but I had problems with the referee on this paper because they said, well, you could still have very strong solar-like differential rotation if you had a very big spot. And the reason I made this figure was, if you had solar-like differential rotation, you want to explain the observations, you would have to have a spot this big and to produce that much TiO. And I said, well, okay, this is substantially lower than this. It's not solar-like differential rotation. That's why I made this plot, but I'm just showing it here.
I must have missed some of the
okay.
argument. What do you mean solar-like differential rotation versus what?
Versus solar-like, I mean in the sense that the equator is rotating faster than the pole, mm-hmm. versus having the pole rotate faster than the equator.
Oh.
Okay, that's all I mean. Let's actually get to magnetic fields now. This is just how we measure it. What we do is we observe line profiles. We use the Zeeman effect. If you think of your star as being covered with some fraction that has no magnetic field, you get a line profile produced by the quiet atmosphere of the star. If you have some fraction that's covered with a magnetic field, 20%, you get Zeeman splitting. If you have a strong field in that region, you get very obvious Zeeman splitting. If you have only a weak field in that region, you get fairly weak splitting. And then you add these two together to get a profile that either looks like that or like that, depending on how strong the field is and what the filling factor of magnetic regions are. And so the basic idea is you look for little shoulders sticking out on either side of the line profile. That's the signature of the magnetic field. The deeper the shoulder is, the greater the filling factor of magnetic regions. The broader the shoulder, the stronger the field. So that's how you try to separate field strength from field filling factor.
Can you actually measure polarization? Right.
We try, but it's not very successful, and that's because if you measure polarization on a star like the Sun that has mixed polarity, they all cancel. All the magnetic regions cancel.
On the right wing, do you measure left polarization, and the left wing, you measure right?
Well, if you have a region that has positive magnetic polarity, this will be right circularly polarized. This will be left circularly polarized. If you have a nearby region that is negative polarity, this will be left circularly polarized. This will be right circularly polarized. So that when you add those two together, they have equal amounts of right and left circular polarization in them. And then so when you take Stokes V, when you difference those two profiles, you get zero.
So does differential rotation do the same thing, or can you, by the polarization, can you tell?
Well, the
can you distinguish magnetic? I mean,
differential rotation certainly wouldn't do this. Differential rotation can broaden the line. Rotation can broaden the line, okay? But it won't give you bumps, and because we're looking for line broadening, here we preferentially observe stars that aren't rotating very fast. And so the magnetic broadening becomes stronger than the rotational broadening. Also, I'll show that this splitting in wavelength is a function of lambda squared, whereas Doppler broadening is a function of lambda. So all that means is observations in the infrared are more sensitive than observations in the optical for measuring magnetic fields. So we try to do our observations in the infrared whenever possible. Let me show the really obvious case first, and also because it's an M dwarf. Shown in the solid histogram is EV Lacerta, and M, I don't think it's M4.5 anymore, Suzanne, is it? What is it? It's M3.5 or something like that, based M4, according to the expert. So it's an M4 flare star. It's a star that has very obvious, very strong flares. It even flares stronger than AD Leo. and then also shown here is a sequence of inactive stars. These stars are not observed to flare, and furthermore, they are observed to show no detectable rotation. Their V sine I is all less than a kilometer per second, but that's an upper limit. We can't measure it. So what I've done is I've artificially rotationally broadened each of their spectra, and that produces the colored sequence here. All this stuff out here is titanium oxide lines. This iron line here is the most Zeeman-sensitive line in the optical, available to optical spectrometers. And what you can see is that out here in the TiO, the blue profile, this Gliese 725, matches pretty much all the features you see, except it doesn't match the core of the iron line. And sticking out on either side are these various very obvious shoulders Those are the Zeeman sigma components sticking out on either side of the line profile. Because they're sticking out so far, you have a pretty good idea that this is a strong magnetic field, and because they're very deep relative to the local continuum defined by the inactive star, you can you have a pretty good guess that it's a substantial filling factor. To make things easier to see, and because it turns out from the laboratory, we don't really know what the wavelengths of titanium oxide are very well. If you want to construct a model atmosphere and you want to predict a spectrum for an M dwarf, the titanium oxide comes out.
Do you see sodium potassium lines, which is close to infrared? Say potassium is very close. Which is not infrared, but it takes a look.
Well, those.
Potassium line. Which,
right.
Well, the sun, it's very important diagnostic, comes from sodium.
Sure.
Classic or potassium lines. And potassium in particular. 769
nanometers. Well, I mean,
which is very close to infrared.
Okay,
infrared.
I haven't looked at it, but it's not that Zeeman sensitive.
Yes.
It's not as sensitive as this guy.
I don't know what they call the sun. Yes, very sensitive.
Fair enough, but on the sun you're measuring fluxes down to 25 Gauss or something like that. 25 Gauss would be completely undetectable on this guy. And so it's sensitive on the sun because you can use polarization.
MDI measures 24. I can measure 0.3 Gauss.
Right. Well, we can't do that on a star. We just can't do it on a star.
Those potassium one lines are really weak, and they don't get strong until about M7 or M8.
So why are they strong in the sun, then? It must be different lines.
No, it's the same line, it's the resonance line.
This star's too cool to have them both.
Right, but yeah. She said M7 or M8, that's colder.
It's like 30%.
Once it does, everything else out, then you
can well. So if I divide this EV Lacerta spectrum by the blue spectrum, by the spectral standard, you get this. All the titanium oxide divides out, and what you're left with is the iron one line, which is very strong, and turns out this is a titanium one line, which was nearby. And this characteristic pattern is the signal of the magnetic field. If you can fit, you can attempt to fit this with a single field value. If you do that and you sort of restrict yourself to matching the core, you would get a field of about 3.8 kilogauss covering 60% of the stellar surface. But we don't then obviously fit this stuff out here. That's indicative of there being more a stronger magnetic field there. So if you abandon the idea of a single field value, but you fit a distribution of magnetic fields, you let there be some 2 kilogauss field, some 4 kilogauss field, some 6 kilogauss field, and some 8 kilogauss field, and then come up with a fit. You could have more choices for magnetic field, but it's degenerate. You can't, just because of the spectral resolution and stuff like that, you can't have an arbitrarily fine distribution. So we fit every 2 kilogauss. If you do that, you then get the fit to, this is the same iron one line, this is the same titanium line. Here's another iron line and another titanium line from another order in our spectrograph. And we get a pretty good fit to the lines. We don't fit everything perfectly, but we did better than the single field value. And if you now add up the filling factor of the 2, the 4, the 6, and the 8 kilogauss field times that field strength, you get a mean field for the star. And that mean field in the case of EV-LAC is 3.9 kilogauss. So it's not that every part of the star has a 3.9 kilogauss field on it, but if you average over all the magnetic structures, you get roughly a 4 kilogauss average field for the stellar surface.
How does that compare with how would that magnetic pressure compare with the gas pressure on the star?
It's a little bit higher, about a factor of 1.3 higher than the gas pressure at tau equals 2/3.
What does the distribution of fields look like? Is it a power law or
something? No, it peaks at about 4 kilogauss, and there's a little bit less 2 kilogauss field, and then less 6, and less 8 kilogauss field. We find that we need up to about 8 kilogauss to fit the very far wings. So it peaks around 3 or 4. Our resolution in that is not that high, right? AD LEO, you get not that I think it's that significant, so I didn't show it, but if you plot the average field versus H alpha equivalent width for Gliese 729, AD LEO, EVLAC, and YZCMI, so only 4 stars, it correlates with H alpha equivalent width. But I don't know exactly what that means, so I didn't show it here. What is the polarization though? Again, these here's AD LEO, for example. So again, the width of this line here is the magnetic field. If there was no magnetic field, you'd have a narrow line similar to what you see in the core here. Sorry, this isn't polarization. This is observing it over the course of, we now have observed, 7 stars over the course of about 3 years, taking, the observations are not equally spaced in time. We first thought, well, we will observe one rotation cycle. We'll look for magnetic modulation on one rotation period. We didn't see anything. So then we looked for a couple of different times a year looking for magnetic modulation. We didn't see anything. So we've now looked for 3 years and we basically don't see anything. If there was strong magnetic modulation, you would see these sigma components varying up and down or the core varying up and down. If you divide each of these by the mean, you get this. And so there's one observation that looks like maybe there's a 4% effect. But I'm a little bit dubious of that because you would kind of expect it to be symmetric on the core and the 2 sigma components. You wouldn't expect it to be one-sided where you have the core and 1 sigma component. So I would say generally at around the 2-3% level, we see no variation in the magnetic field on M stars, middle M stars. These are all M3, M4, M5 stars. We see no variation over the course of 3 years. That might mean that there aren't strong activity cycle periods on them. Again, not much is known. I've seen in the literature one paper based on photometry, U-band photometry, where they say EVLAC might have a 5-year magnetic cycle.
Do you see variation with the rotation?
Nope. Don't see variation with rotation.
So does it mean you look at the pole or?
No, the V-sine I have these.
The field is axisymmetric.
What I think it means is the field is dominated by small bipoles like the sun is, but you got a lot of complicated field geometry on the star. You don't have large magnetic structures on the star, but a lot of small ones. Here is a rough cut at some of the polarization. We went and looked back at, again, this is AD LEO. We looked through right circularly polarized light. We looked through left circularly polarized light. This is the data basically taken right off the telescope, so I haven't removed things like cosmic rays that you can see poking up here and there. And the difference is Stokes V, our right minus left, and it's this very flat thing here. You see no polarization signal in the 2 sigma components or in the core, though you wouldn't expect it in the core. You wouldn't expect Stokes V. So again, that's telling us, I think, that there's a lot of complicated magnetic field geometry. There's just as much positive polarity field as there is negative polarity field on the surface of the star.
So that means you don't have a few really big spots.
Not a few big spots, a lot of little ones.
Does that reflect at all on the polar spots? We're talking about polar with faster rotating stars, but it just seemed to be at a, like AB Dorofsky, you had a big pole tilted toward you, you ought to have a big...
If that was a dipole, if that was indicative of a dipole, yes, we should see polarization. But if that's, magnetic loops that just happen to emerge near the pole and each one of them is a bipole. So if you have your star and it's radiative core and you just had the loops all rise towards the equator and they all poke out with a positive and a negative thing, then you wouldn't expect to see polarization. And so I think what that is, people have looked at some of these more rapidly rotating stars with polarization, and again, they don't see any signal. So I think that's evidence that it's not, the polar spots aren't a big dipole. Just getting back to T Tauri stars, they do rotate a little bit faster than the M-dwarfs, and so we go out to the infrared, and what we observe are these titanium lines out in the infrared at about 2.2 microns. They turn out to be very magnetically sensitive. It turns out almost all the metallic lines in the infrared are magnetically sensitive, which can be bad for testing the null case, except there are these CO lines that are also very prevalent at temperatures of T Tauri stars. So we're talking temperatures of about 4,000 degrees. So what I'm showing here are main sequence dwarfs, inactive main sequence dwarfs at about 4,000 degrees. The CO lines don't have any magnetic sensitivity. So if you have a star that doesn't have a magnetic field, you expect the CO lines to be as broad as the titanium lines. If you have a star that does have a magnetic field, you expect the titanium lines to be much broader than the CO lines, because the CO lines just aren't sensitive to the magnetic field. So when you look at the T Tauri stars, you see narrow CO lines and you see very broad titanium 1 lines. They are so broad that, again, a single field doesn't fit the data. You need a distribution of field strengths to fit the data. And here is the distribution for this classical T Tauri star. This is TW Haia. So we get about 20% with no field, 40% with a 2 kilogauss field, 30% with a 4 kilogauss field, 10% with a 6 kilogauss field. That spectrum is shown in the red profile, and it fits the data fairly well. The data is the histogram. The zero field model is the yellow profile that shows the very narrow titanium lines because there's no field. It also shows the very narrow CO lines.
How constrained is this fitting since you now have so many more parameters?
Well, I mean, I can't tell the difference. if I were to put in, I could fit it equally well with zero, or say 0, 1, 3, and 5 or something like that, and you would get something with more or less the same shape. And in fact, when you add these up and you get this mean field, that mean field is good to 10%. But the exact distribution, there's more play in it. We've done this now for several T Tauri stars. Here is BP Tau, one of my personal favorites. And again, we always find a distribution that peaks around 2 kilogauss. But if it's 2 or 3 kilogauss, I can't really tell you the difference between that. The mean fields all typically are between about 2 and 3 kilogauss. I think TW Haia was 2.6, and we have some that go up as high as 2.8. This one is Hubble 4. It's rotating a little bit more rapidly. That's why the CO lines are broader. But again, the titanium lines are even broader. And so it's clear that there's a magnetic field there, and the mean field is about 2.4 kilogauss. As I said before, the theorists, at least, think there are these big dipole fields on these T Tauri stars, and that's what stops the disk from coming in. So if there are dipole fields on the star, then polarization should show it up, should let you see it. And so but it turns out the polarization the polarization you get from a dipole field isn't equal to the polar field strength. It's equal to something a little bit less because there's a little bit of cancellation. The field lines at the equator are pointing off and not along the line of sight. It turns out if you take this field that we measure for BP tau, and assume that it's a dipole, and you get its mean field, you ask, how strong a dipole do you need to give this mean field?
Do you use a Stokes profile to reconstruct it,
No, this is just Stokes I, just intensity.
Okay, so you use this shape of your line.
Just use the shape of the line to get the mean field strength. Then if you assume that is a dipole, and ask what polarization should it give you, it should give you this wavelength difference for this iron line at 8468 between left and right strictly polarized light. Could be flipped if the field's negative instead of positive. But the point is, this is what we observe. We observe no wavelength shift. We observe no polarization from the photospheric lines of T Tauri stars. The limit, the 3 sigma upper limit we can place on them is about 180 gauss, and the prediction is 800 gauss. So we're several sigma below what the predictions are. And so I can fairly safely say the magnetic fields on T Tauri stars are not large-scale dipoles.
The 800 gauss is the prediction. It's if the average field strength is 2 kilogauss?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. And you have to take the inclination for the star, and we get that from just V sine I and rotation period. The question was asked earlier, how does the field strength we measure on the mDORFs compare to the gas pressure? And so this plot addresses that. As a function of effective temperature, we have taken the gas pressure of the star at the tau equals two-thirds level, so at where the temperature in the atmosphere equals the effective temperature. And if you translate that gas pressure into a magnetic field strength, you get this line for main sequence stars. The models we use are the models of Allard and Hauschild. They're next generation models. The asterisks here are magnetic field measurements from main sequence stars, and our four mDORFs are all up here. So they're a factor of a 1.3 higher.
So the model doesn't fit to observations.
Not too well. At least it rises, and they both rise in the same direction as opposed to going in the opposite direction. But it looks like our fields are stronger than can be confined by the gas pressure on the stellar surface. What's more dramatic, though, is these T-Tauri stars, where we're measuring mean fields up here around 2 to 3 kilogauss. These are low gravity stars. These are stars where the gas pressure is substantially less than on a main sequence star. And so now the prediction is somewhere down here, and you're now a factor of 2, 2.5 lower than can be confined by the gas pressure. So what I think this means, at least for the case of the T-Tauri stars, where there's a fairly dramatic difference, the T-Tauri stars are shown in these solid circles. What I think this means is that the entire star, the entire visible photosphere, is covered by magnetic field. You can think of the visible photosphere of a T-Tauri star as sort of like the chromosphere on the sun. You look at an H-alpha picture of the sun, I think that's what a white light picture of a T-Tauri star would look like if you could resolve it. And naturally, I would expect that would have some effect on the temperature structure on the star. And to my knowledge, nobody has calculated that effect of the magnetic field, because convection should be completely inhibited in the outer atmosphere of these stars. And these certainly have convective outer envelopes. And so I've now argued that our models are inconsistent with the data, but I don't have any better models, so that's what I have to use. Let me just quickly say something about iron hydride. Iron hydride, here's a laboratory spectrum of iron hydride. Here's a sunspot spectrum of iron hydride. And you can see that everywhere that there's a line in the laboratory spectrum, there's a fairly strong line in the sunspot spectrum. But note out here, there are lines that are very narrow. And over here, there are lines if you have these two lines and you actually broaden them, or this line and you broaden it, you see evidence of broadening in a sunspot. So there's a magnetic field. There's a 3 kilogauss magnetic field, 3.6 kilogauss magnetic field in the sunspot. So it was basically these observations of sunspots that show that iron hydride is magnetically sensitive. And iron hydride is nice because when you go to later spectral types, when you go to M9 and so in those spectral types, all the atomic features disappear because all those elements are going into molecules. And so you can't use titanium one lines. You can't use iron one lines to measure the magnetic field. You need a magnetically sensitive molecule, and iron hydride is such a molecule, and it actually gets stronger as you go to lower temperatures. So it offers you to extend this type of work to the brown dwarfs to confirm that they are magnetic, and as opposed to not magnetic, and that separates that heating problem versus the dynamo problem. Sort of as a proof of concept, what we did is we took a spectrum of AD Leo, which is shown in this red line, and also shown here is the inactive mDORF. So these are the same two stars. Remember when I showed you the division of EV-LAC by a spectral standard? Well, that spectral standard was this Gliese 725B, and that showed the magnetic field in the iron one line. If you look at the Gliese 725B spectrum, this line over here is very narrow, but these two lines over here are also quite narrow. But if you look at the spectrum of AD Leo, this line again is still narrow, but now these two have merged into one big broad thing, just like the sunspot did. So it's showing the magnetic sensitivity of this line in AD Leo. And in fact, if you take 70% of the sunspot spectrum and add it to 30% of the Gliese 725b spectrum, you reproduce the AD Leo spectrum. So we've sort of fit AD Leo with 70% of a 3.6 kilogauss field. And before, when we were fitting the iron one line, we fit it with 60% of a 3.8 kilogauss field. So we get pretty much the same answer between iron hydride and things like iron one and titanium one and stuff like that. The problem with this is iron hydride, they don't know much about it in terms of its splitting patterns. They don't know its magnetic splitting patterns. So it's not so useful right now in terms of predicting models at different temperatures and different field strengths. There's currently laboratory work going on to address that, but you can't go out and measure everything in iron hydride right now. But another thing that is important is these sunspots. Iron hydride shows up in sunspots, but it doesn't show up in the quiet sun. So now you can look at some of these stars with big polar spots, and the iron hydride will be coming only from the big polar spot. And so then you can measure, is it a magnetic polar spot, or is it just something to do with convection being shut off and has nothing to do with a magnetic field? So iron hydride, I think, will allow us to answer questions both about polar spots and about, and that's what that's saying, and also measure magnetic fields on the very late type stars and the brown dwarfs. So here are some conclusions. I'll just let you read them, and I'll answer any other questions that you might have.
Is there anything, I'm just trying to get sort of the overall qualitative differences between the magnetic activities in the two plastics?
None has been detected.
No,
As near as we can tell, the star in a classical T-Tauri star, so a star that has a disk around it, is identical to a star that doesn't have a disk around it, but it's at the same age and the same mass and the same rotation.
That has implications for models and people.
Well, okay, there is one difference. The ones without disks tend to be rotating faster. Okay, and the belief is that somehow or another, the stellar magnetic field is coupling the star to the disk, and that's regulating the rotation rate of the star. Once the disk goes away, as the star begins to contract towards the main sequence, it spins up because it's the ice skater bringing in their arms.
When you're talking about this kilogauss mean field without general dipole, how do we envision them? We have plus and minuses, and you average, it still have kilogauss?
Mm-hmm. So I think you've got a bunch of...
So how about
unsigned,
the...
That's the unsigned average.
Unsigned
good value average.
Yeah. So which doesn't go into V profile, it goes into this...
Only goes into I.
Into Doppler spread, which could be produced by anything.
Well, I mean, no, it's a shape.
Yeah.
He showed it was not...
One way. So if I get magnetic field reset, I can fit in the shape. But nobody came out with another explanation.
But the non-magnetic lines, you showed the rotation, there's no rotting. Yeah. The only thing rotting are magnetic lines, non-magnetic.
That's the point.
So you go back to this one. These lines down here, these CO lines, they are broadened by rotation. No question about it, they're broadened by rotation. But their Zeeman sensitivity, their Lande G values are equal to zero. So there's no magnetic splitting of these lines. So that tells you what the rotation is. That maps into these lines for the atomic lines, but they're observed to be much broader than that. So it has to be something that affects only atomic lines. It has to be something that affects them in proportion to their Lande G values, and so I think that means their magnetic fields.
Well, there are now some beginning to be some good models of these atmospheres with the convection done properly, similar probably by Hans Ludwig.
Right.
I've showed them the other,
sure,
those other people. And so, you know, you should probably keep in touch with that because those are going to be much better models.
And I've talked some with Peter, and he's pretty interested in this whole notion, and I'm so he's willing to run models for me with convection, say, turned off, which I think is the case for some of these Tauri stars. And the other thing I would like to do, though it's going to require a lot of groundwork in terms of what you should expect, and then also maybe a big telescope because these guys are relatively faint, but you can potentially look at line bisectors. And if there's very strong magnetic fields that are shutting off convection on the outer atmosphere, then you would expect the line bisectors to be different than if they weren't there. But nobody has really done much work. Nobody's done any work on line bisectors in T Tauri stars, and nobody's done much for convective M dwarfs.
One of the things you have to be careful of is that, you know, you can have strong magnetic fields, but they tend to still get displaced from regions. So you have alternating regions where there's convection and where there's field and there's pressure.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It doesn't have to shut off. The heat has to get out somehow. And when there's a very strong magnetic field, rather than shutting off convection everywhere, the tendency is to expulse it from convective regions and concentrate it into certain parts. And
right.
So you have convective parts and magnetic parts where there's essentially no convection.
What surprised me is stability of these 3.3 kilogauss. If they produce by a bunch of sort of spots and regions, even if you have unsigned average,
right,
it's very difficult to keep it. Dynamics change.
Look at the size. Not necessarily spots. These are like these small-scale dynamo kind of things. It's everywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
They're changing.
But it's separated out from the convection.
No, we have intermittency in time. That's what.
You
look for 3 years and it still stays.
But if it's a small scale field, the time constant's low.
Yeah, it's like granulation. It's you're seeing, and you'd have a
granulation is stable, but magnetic field generated by this granulation is very intermittent.
No, but what I'm saying is, if you look at one little spot on the sun, you would see the temperature go up and down because there's a granulation pattern that's in. Sometimes you're looking in the middle of this granule, and sometimes you're looking at the edge. But if you average over all those granules, you see a more or less constant temperature.
And you see the same thing for the field.
How much information about the convection do you get from the line widths?
Almost none.
Really? So
I think you need to look at bisectors. These guys, at least in the T Tauri stars, they're rotating at 10 kilometers per second, and that's factor 10 higher than the convective velocities.
So Chris, if the magnetic regions were like they were in the sun, they were actually dark, your intensity in the magnetic signal would be actually even smaller than what we see.
Right, and in fact, I brushed that completely under the rug. What I have assumed is that the magnetic regions are equally bright as the quiet regions. If they're dark, my filling factors all go up. So that instead of 90%, I get 95%.
And they're likely to be darker even if there's not spots. Because the field collects. And,
right.
Yeah, convection collects in the intergranular lanes. So the lanes are between whatever magnetic structure.
So I want to go back to the comment you made, though. I understand on a star like the sun, where if you shut off convection, the heat goes out to the side because there's not much magnetic field there. But what if I put magnetic field everywhere? What if I put a 4 kilogauss field everywhere? Can the convection
still get shoved around some?
Why won't it just adjust its temperature structure so that the atmosphere is
because
moving at what the radiation can carry?
It's very simple. What happens is you shut off convection. Okay, you put it in and shut it off. It's still cooling. So the outer parts get cooling. You get a steeper and steeper gradient, and then at some point, convection stops.
Yeah, it's unstable. If you have a
then you'll see the variation.
Some line of magnetic field, and you perturb it a little bit so that some convection gets through, then it'll tend to get pushed around and concentrated.
Right. But as I increase the temperature gradient, then I've also increased the diffusion, the diffusion of the photons, right? So why can't it get to a situation where the photons can carry all the energy? Why does the convection have to carry the energy?
I think what happens is that you reach the point where you can drive the convection in spite of the field before you can carry all the energy.
What would be interesting?
But we haven't made experiments on those cool stars.
Right, well.
I think it's conceivable, but I think it's unlikely. I think it would be unstable.
I think what would be interesting is,
the way you
could test this is to shut off, artificially shut off convection, at the outer shell, and run the stellar models. What I think it should puff out, because you still have to get the same luminosity.
Right, and so if you make a bigger star, you've got a less smaller flux.
I agree, I mean, so that's why I've
reached a point where I need you theorists to go run models. to model a star that has a 4 kilogauss field everywhere, and see if does the star puff up as a result? Does the convection eventually win? Does the temperature structure change? Right now, I'm assuming the temperature structure is as if there were no fields there. And so what I would really like to know is, what is the temperature structure I should be using? Is what I'm using good enough, or is it different?
Probably different.
How different?
Have to do it in some
Okay, there you go.
The first point that you made, you said heating in fully convective stars is weaker.
Some hints, and that's because the T Tauri stars are below the X-ray magnetic flux.
Referring actually to the IHK versus inverse Rossby diagram, or which one?
I was referring to.
No, to the one versus magnetic flux.
X-ray emission versus magnetic flux.
Yeah. I was referring to this one, in which the T Tauri stars are a little bit below the line, and to this one where. In transition region emission, the 4 fully convective stars are these guys, and they're on the low side. It's only 4 stars. The HST TAC continues to turn me down to make this be 30 stars instead of 4 stars, but I keep trying.
So how does it look like in the HRK diagram versus inverse Rossby in the very first one?
Yeah, I guess I don't actually know the answer to that, because the HK project doesn't observe these stars.
But you could plot them.
I could plot them if I had the data, but I haven't done that.
Do you need to use HST, or can you use something else?
I need an ultraviolet spectrometer.
You need to ultraviolet.
Or, I mean,
you... But you're talking about infrared, too.
But that's, I mean, the infrared is mainly magnetic field. Now, if you wanted, I could use, I could... try and do calcium HNK, but isn't there an idea that the HK emission, the chromospheric emission, shifts from calcium to hydrogen?
Yeah, that's part of your heat.
Right. So, if you want to do it with the diagnostics people have already done, they've done a lot of work with ultraviolet data, they've done a lot of work with some of these other things, and I think the ultraviolet is certainly useful. There are other reasons I want to use the ultraviolet data that aren't related to heating, but. Any other questions? All righty.
So if there's no dipolar field, how does the accretion disk couple?
Well,
the accretion disk make the star accrete.
If the dipole field was a factor of 10 to 20 weaker than what I'm measuring, I wouldn't be able to measure it, and so maybe it's that weaker dipole component that's doing the coupling. Now, I think it is a very fair question whether or not that is strong enough to do everything the theorists want to be done in the case of the T Tauri stars. Yes.
I didn't like the food that much.
I think they're there.
Oh, from there.
Yeah, they're from that compilation of SAR that's in, our measurements are in that compilation of SAR, actually.
I'm sorry,
there were, those guys were there.
We are doing some simulations now for the sun with these small-scale fields.
Mm-hmm.
If those turn out to be successful, Hans Gunther has been using our non-magnetic code. It would be easy to give him the other routines and ask him to do the stuff with magnetic fields. We ought to know in a few months whether that's worthwhile.
That'd be great. And one thing that in particular I would like to know is for like a Titori star, what should the convective signature be in, say, a line bisector?
Right.
And so is that measurable? And then if you put a magnetic field in there, does that make a measurable difference?
He's done the very cool stars without field. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but he hasn't done it with field.
Okay.
We are just doing stuff with field now for the sun.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to see where that goes in.
Well, I'll be very interested to see what you get.